there was a Teen Vogue article about the fact that some idiot Academy voter was like, I'm not going to vote for a movie about periods. They're icky. Literally used the word icky. The new school.
This is The New School with your host, Christine Hong. Welcome to a new kind of school, where we talk about career paths you don't normally get to hear about in the classroom. Every episode, I talk to someone with an interesting life path and learn about how they got to where they are today. My guest today is Sophie Asheim. Now, this lady is badass. At age 16, she helped start a nonprofit called The Pad Project, which helps give access to menstrual products for women and girls in low-income communities. Now, I didn't realize how big an issue this is, but literally so many girls across the world drop out of school because they don't have the proper resources to handle their periods, which is completely insane to me. For The Pad Project, she helped produce a documentary called Period, End of Sentence, which is on Netflix now, which later got her an Oscar at age 19 for Best Documentary Short. The passion this girl has for what she does is super inspiring, and it really showed me that no matter what age you are, anyone can make a difference in the world. For the first half of the interview, we talk about how she helped start a nonprofit, and then for the second half, we cover the documentary and how it ended up winning an Oscar.
Hi, Sophie. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on to our show. I'm really excited to have you here.
Hi, Christine. Thank you so much for having me.
Cool. So, where to start? Okay, I'm wondering, did you always have an interest in nonprofits or filmmaking? Or, like, what was your childhood like?
Yeah. I definitely had somewhat of a background in both, considering that my mom is a doctor but has done work with nonprofits for at least the last 10 years and has actually been on the board of a couple. And then my dad works in television. So I kind of did have an exposure to both sides. I think, like, watching my dad and, like, what media he was focused on, which was mostly children's media, it really did show me, like, the power of storytelling, especially how it can impact audiences about, like, social issues and stuff like that. And then I also think, like, the on-the-ground work that my mom and her nonprofit was doing really impacted me, because, like, you hear about all these nonprofits and the great work they're doing, but I think it's hard to conceptualize, especially at a young age, like, the work that goes into that. And so I think having been exposed to both was very helpful in kind of putting together the idea of the PAD project, just in terms of, like, marrying, like, concrete on the ground work with media and storytelling.
Yeah. So did you have any experience with working on a nonprofit before this personally?
Not really. I had never worked directly with a nonprofit before. I mean, this started when I was in high school. So
yeah, you were like 14, right?
I was 16, 15. Okay. 15 when we launched the Kickstarter. Thinking back, I hadn't even, like, interned at a nonprofit, which I did, like, the summer after. But
it's a big one to start with. Yeah.
I mean, I love, like, watching TV and movies. I was never super interested in making them. Yeah. I think that we kind of came at both the nonprofit and the documentary from a perspective of, like, how do we label what we're doing? This didn't start with us saying we want to start a nonprofit and we want to create an award-winning documentary. I think this very much started with an idea and a connection we had to Katakira, the women of Katakira, and Action India, and a problem that seemed very solvable with the right kind of, like, money and influence.
That's awesome. Yeah. Speaking of how the project started, how did you even hear about the problem in the first place?
So how our group got started on it was about 8 years ago. Our school had a very long history of having a local chapter of a club called Girls Learn International, which is just the high school program under the Feminist Majority Foundation, which is another very cool nonprofit. As chapters, sometimes they send different chapters to the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women each year. And about 8 years ago, my English teacher / our executive director went with her daughter and one other student to the CSW. And that was when they first kind of learned about the issue of lack of access to menstrual products.
Sorry, the CSWQ?
Commission on the Status of Women.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's the UN conference about, like, women's rights.
Oh, is that something she does regularly? So
we went through, we were able to go as official delegates through Girls Zone International because they, like, partner with the UN frequently. And so, like, that was the first year they went, although we have gone back since. Like, 5 years ago, three more girls on our team went, and then 3 years ago, I went with a couple other girls on our team. So it's, like, as part of a club we were doing in high school, this was an opportunity we had. Oh. But that was where they first learned about just, like, lack of access to menstrual products and where it was ever first really talked about. And so that kind of got the idea started in the back of their heads a little bit. And then, because that was also when they learned about the machine. But then the idea kind of died down for a little bit.
Oh, a machine to make pads.
Yes. So, yeah. Like, it was kind of, the problem was introduced to them by way of someone talking about this machine.
Yeah, and wait, then, so what is this UN conference like? And I'm sure they're talking about so many different problems.
They're talking about so many things. So every year has a different theme. So the year I went, the theme was I think it was economic empowerment of rural women and girls. And we, the different events and, like, conferences we went to within that week were so intense and, like, wide-ranging about anything from, like, female genital mutilation to violence against women to, like, very kind of more mundane and much less violent issues as well. Like, basically, it's just, like, where most member nations get together and almost all partner organizations and NGOs with the UN get together for a week and talk about women's issues and girls' issues and how that relates to sustainable development goals of the UN, but also just, like, what can be done. And so that was where we first learned about the issue and actually where we first premiered the documentary 5 years later, which was really cool. Because we were able to host, as an NGO partner, we were able to host a PAD project event at the CSW, which is where this all started. So that was a lovely full circle.
Full circle, yeah.
That was really cool.
Wait, so I'm so curious, like, you're hearing about these problems, you heard about this pad making machine, like, how did you all decide to focus on this particular problem out of all the problems out there?
I think it was something that we felt connected to pretty early on, just because, as a woman. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really easy problem to connect to if you have a uterus. like, I think that those of us who are lucky to have never had to consider what it would be like to not have access to pads and tampons and have them be abundant, and, like, let alone everything else we use to deal with our periods, which is, like, Advil, heating pads, chocolate, everything else. Like, we take all of that for granted. I never really thought about it, like, in developing communities, but also in our own community in terms of, like, low-income and homeless populations. Like, that's a huge issue that's just not being talked about. Because, like, I remember all the fundraisers we did in lower school for different homeless shelters, but we always brought in, like, shampoo and conditioner and soap. None of us ever brought in pads or tampons. And so, like, if no one's talking about it and there's this huge stigma placed around it, then the problem's never going to get better. And so I think for all those reasons, it was a problem we felt very connected to. And also because we already had an established connection with the community in Katsukira through our partner organization, Action India, through Girls Zone International. We've had a relationship with Action India for over 20 years.
We is the club you were part of?
Yeah. Girls Zone International has had a relationship with Action India for over 20 years. And Action India has established their own Girls Zone International chapters. And so over a couple of Skype calls with our partner school in the area through Girls Zone International, we kind of asked, like, is this really a problem? Like, do you guys not have access to pads and tampons? And I think that's just the silence that was the answer. It's like they were so not comfortable talking to us about any of that. And so I think that's kind of when it hit us that, like, yeah, periods can be kind of embarrassing and make us giggle, but, like, they're not debilitating. They don't change the course of our lives in that fundamental way. And I think that we all just kind of had this sense of, like, well, that's super messed up. the machine was such a simple solution, and we had this relationship with Action India. We were fortunate enough to have ways to fund the machine, and it would not only provide pads to the community, but it would also helpfully kickstart a microeconomy in the community. It would provide wages for women who are working on the machine where they would normally be doing manual labor or running their household and not being paid. So it, for, like, all of those reasons, I think, like, it felt like a very natural solution for both groups. And so that's kind of where we got started.
Right, because before the pad machines, the documentary was saying that women would just wear their normal clothes and they just wash them after.
So they would buy cloth specifically to use as, like, kind of like underwear. So they would just bleed onto it and then change it out and wash it. But just the knowledge of, like, hygiene in general is very low in very remote areas of India and many other countries, that there wasn't really a lot of recognition about the fact that, okay, well, if you're going to use cloth, which is, like, totally great, you have to wash it first. Otherwise, if the cloth is dirty, let's say there's dirt on it or it was on the floor or something, and then you put that against your vagina while you're on your period, then that can lead to serious infections and is one of the reasons that India has one of the highest rates of cervical cancer in the world. And so, like, it's just, there's so many things you don't think of. You're like, okay, well, maybe we just, like, keep donating actual pads that, like, we buy in the US at, like, drugstores and just send them over. But it's like, there's so many more root issues that just, like, dumping a bunch of pads on a village won't fix.
Because they will run out. Yeah.
Not only will they run out, it's like, there isn't educational training along with that to explain why it's important to switch to pads, why it's better for your health, why it'll help you actually, like, get a job and sustain a job, why you should stay in school, all of that. Because I think that, like, even if we just set up the machine and said, okay, amazing, have fun, it would be a failure. Like, it wouldn't work, because then it would just be a job and there wouldn't be that sort of, like, social transformation in terms of, like, people talking about periods, people talking about pads, people talking about, okay, well, even if you don't want to use a pad, you want to use a cloth, you have to wash it, you have to change it out, you have to take care of yourself, like, all of that. And so I think part of what made this so successful was our relationship with Action India and the fact that Action India has been doing these educational training and, like, nearby communities for a very long time. And so they were very well already established in the community. And so the Katakira specifically was very receptive to both machine and working with us, because they had had years and years of Action India trying to normalize stuff that we take for granted.
Yeah, there is one woman in documentary, she mentioned while she was at school, she felt so uncomfortable changing in front of boys that she would just end up dropping out of school. But I'm so confused, like, were there not bathrooms at school?
No. So India has a ton of, like, publicly funded schools, which are, like, in the US, there's a very large range in what that means. And depending on where you live, those could be amazing schools. But, like, if you're not in Delhi or Mumbai, chances are they're not. And they are usually just, like, single buildings or a series of buildings kind of in between a couple of villages. So they're a very far walk from your home.
So they end up having just, like, pee in the woods and change pads in the woods?
Yeah, but that's really not safe because, I mean, it's mentioned a bit in the documentary, but, like, if you go out even in the evening when it's still light out to try and, like, bury your rag in the woods or in the fields, that puts you at super high risk for sexual assault. Yeah.
How are you peeing? I'm so confused.
So I think they had, like, the facilities to pee and go to the bathroom, but not clean water in order to wash their rag, or there was too much hassle, there wasn't enough privacy. That became a huge barrier, because then you would just stay home when you're on your period. And if you add up all the time you're missing at school, you're going to fall so far behind that you might as well drop out, especially because in Indian culture and many other countries as well, girls' education is not as emphasized as boys' education.
Wow.
And even in big cities like Delhi or Mumbai, for less well-off people, if you're going to go, if you have a pad or even if you have a rag and there are many, like, public bathrooms, it's a really not safe place to be as a woman alone. It is, there are such high rates of sexual assault and just different, like, violent incidents. And actually some of the work that Action India did, which was super transformational, was creating just, like, networks of women who would either walk together or kind of stand guard in a way around these public bathrooms in order to protect other women. But, like, the fact that that's even necessary is insane.
No, that's ridiculous. I cannot imagine that. When you talked with Action India, were they the ones who suggested, like, hey, like, let's figure out a way that these women can make their own pad making machines?
Yeah. So I think we reached out to them with, like, oh, we had heard about this thing. Like, can you tell us a bit more about it? Because the machine was created in India. And, like, by a man named Muruganandam, who's a very funny story, which is, there's a whole documentary about him, which is worth watching. But we basically reached out to them and said, hi, have you heard of Muruganandam? is this viable? Is this feasible? Is this something you guys would want to do with us? Because we can raise the money to fund the machine and the first year's worth of supplies so that the women can just focus on making the pads and like starting the microeconomy rather than like worrying about whether or not they can move on to the next year. And it took a very long time. Like, we first learned about the machine 8 or 9 years ago, and the machine was installed in this winter of 2017.
Oh, wow. So it took 6 years?
Yeah, it took 6 years from hearing about the machine to actually getting the machine on the ground.
Why? Is it really expensive and hard to build?
It is expensive. I think the machine we installed was about $5,000 or $6,000, and then the materials were another $5,000 or $6,000. So it ended up being around $12,000. Machines that are now being produced are somewhere more around $12,000, like alone, but are functionally much better machines.
Is it literally just taking is the material like cotton or something, and it's turning into something sticky? It's a tree bark that's
been turned into like a cotton-like substance, like a very soft absorbent substance. And then, yeah, it's painted with a layer of like a sticky residue and then wrapped.
Intriguing. Because you were saying 6,000 materials. How many pads can that make?
So many. I don't have an exact number, but like thousands and thousands and thousands. Like, the machine can make about 600 pads a day.
Wow. Okay. And then all they have to do is just get some tree bark and like...
It's a specific tree bark, and it's then like it's processed pretty finely. It's a little bit like the idea of turning trees into paper. You shave it down like into very, very thin layers, make it into pulp, compress it, and then what they do is they then fluff it back up. So it comes all compressed in like these big things, which look a little bit like hay bales. And it's just like this giant roll. It's like a Swiss roll. And then you break off bits and like put it in this little machine that like fluffs it back up. And then that is then put into a specific press and compressed into the shape of a pad. And from there, like, packaged.
Fascinating. You learned so much while working on this.
Yeah, it is. It's been a very educational process on so many levels.
Okay. So you want to help locals create these pad making machines, but how did the nonprofit, the PAD project, get involved? How did the documentary get involved?
Yeah. So, I think growing up, so I grew up in New York, but, most of the girls involved in the project had grown up in Los Angeles. I had moved there a couple of years before I got started with this.
And this is the Oakwood School, right?
Yes.
In Los Angeles.
Yes. And so I think like just seeing, growing up in Hollywood and seeing the impact that media can have and storytelling and visual storytelling can have, I think was kind of what put the idea of filming and like documenting this into our heads. And like, it was going to be like kind of a student film. Like, there were a lot of things that like had to happen before it became period end of sentence. So I think we did have an idea of like, okay, well, we can use this story to spread the word about the issue and the fact that like no one knows about it. Through a connection that one of the parents involved in the project had, we were introduced to our director, Rika Zatabchi. She was a recent graduate of USC Film School, and she kind of came on board right before we launched the Kickstarter, looked at the video we were going to put on our Kickstarter and said, nope, we're going to redo that.
What's the original video?
It was bad. Like, it was really bad. Because, like, we were trying to, like, overproduce it so much. And she was like, okay, literally just, like, sit in this chair and talk to me. And ended up creating, like, a very impactful 3-minute video, which is still on our Kickstarter and still on our website, about, like, why we cared about this issue, what we were trying to do, what the Kickstarter was for, and all of that. And I think we kind of then realized, okay, like, we really, really need her. Like, she was a young woman, so I think the issue was also very personal to her as well. But like on all levels, we locked into her.
What was the goal of the Kickstarter and how much money were you looking to raise?
So the goal of the Kickstarter was to fund the documentary and the machine and the first year's worth of supplies. Mm-hmm. We ended up raising over around $45,000.
Is that enough to make a movie though? Movies are expensive.
Movies are expensive, which we realized. So we first raised about $35,000 and then had to raise an additional $11,000 to finish the documentary, just in terms of like post-production. But within that budget, we were able to fully create, edit the documentary, and also purchase the machine and the supplies and like get that up and running.
Wow. So what's involved in shooting this? You have to get a crew to
so we kept
go
it
on
very small, very intentionally, because I think it felt very irresponsible otherwise, just in terms of like we were already creating a disturbance in Katakira by installing a machine, and there was already enough like pushback against that that it would feel like very irresponsible to then show up with like a whole crew and movie cameras, and also that was just not in our budget. So we kept it very, very small. It was literally just our director and her partner, who was our director of photography. He also edited most of the documentary. And so they were kind of our dream team. And since it was literally just them, someone from there was an Indian producer who came on board who was amazing, and she sent one of her line producers down with them, literally just to, like, translate. And so that was the crew. It was as small as possible. They shot for 1 week, and then they went back 6 months later and shot for another week. So it was over 2 weeks.
Oh, wait, why 6 months apart?
Because I think the first time they went was, and you kind of see in the documentary, the first time they went was when the machine was being installed, and then the second time they went was about 6 months later to kind of see the impact, early stages of like, is this gonna work?
That's true. It was really cool because they were saying, I got a job now, so my husband respects me.
Yeah, and so that was like a lot of that was filmed like the 6 months later.
That's awesome. I heard that the director, she would give you all footage frequently and you guys would give feedback, and that was the editing process. How did that work?
In a way. So I think we were as involved as we could be, given that we were like high school juniors and seniors at this point who didn't know anything about film. And so she would come in and give us, like, when they had rough cuts, that she would come and show us. And like, especially when she first got back, she just showed us like a rough cut of just like footage untranslated, just like how beautiful it was and everything. And like, we were involved in the naming process and all of that. So I think that like, from that perspective, we were as involved as we could be, but like in the actual hands-on editing, like that was very much them.
Yeah. Wait, what's the difference between executive producer and producer?
So a producer is like kind of on the ground, like physically making it happen. And an executive producer is more like the force behind it that made the situation possible.
Because you all got the money through Kickstarter, your executive producer.
Yeah. So those of us who were involved in the nonprofit were executive producers because of our role in the nonprofit and the Kickstarter and all of that. But because we weren't like literally hands-on involved in the film.
Yeah. Wait, is there any particular footage you're sad was cut out and wasn't in the final film?
One story that Rika did tell us, which footage just had to be cut for time, and also because, like, God, that sounds so hard to watch. The scene in the documentary where they're in a classroom and the teacher asks the girls to just explain what a period is, and there's that girl who looks a little bit like she's about to pass out and can't really speak. Mm-hmm. But there are two girls sitting next to each other. The first one had been called on by the teacher and was asked to stand up and say it, and she couldn't. She like literally just stood there and like for a solid 2 minutes straight and couldn't say anything. And then her friend stood up to try to say something, and she was the one who finally stammered out something. But like that was about 5 minutes of footage where these girls were just so mortified. And like, while it's an incredibly powerful moment in the film, part of me is very hesitant to like, there's something so visceral about watching someone be so embarrassed for something that is so natural.
Yeah. Because,
like, to me, I mean, especially now, I mean, I've spent the last 3 years of my life literally just talking about periods, so like I'm very comfortable with it, but like, I don't know, the idea of like someone being that embarrassed about it, that it seems like it would cause them physical harm, is insane.
Yeah, that's really sad. Is what's next for the PAP project? What else do y'all want to do?
We're just focused on reaching out and working with as many communities as possible. We are in the process of making and creating relationships with different communities and seeing if a pad machine is a viable solution for them, or if where we can work with them in other aspects. We are very aware that this is not a one-size-fits-all solution and not a one-size-fits-all problem, in the sense that like there are going to be communities that reach out and don't need any educational background but want a machine, especially for the economic empowerment aspect. And then there are going to be communities who reach out and want a more sustainable option. Although the pads are 97% biodegradable, a more sustainable option is just the sense of like maybe menstrual cups and stuff like that. So I think that like we are very much focused on meeting communities wherever they're at and working with them as best we can. And also just focused on like learning and expanding our advocacy Yeah, it's definitely been a long process, but we're also just getting started, which is like funny to think about because I feel like I've been doing this my whole life. But
wait, how are you doing this while in school? Like, what? How much work do you put into this every week?
It's a lot to manage while in school, which is I think why it's taken us so long to get where we are, because we've always been doing this kind of in the back around school and other like family commitments and stuff like that and other extracurriculars. So we now finally have two people on our staff, like working full time, full salary, and our executive director, who is also still teaching at Oakwood. So she's doing two jobs right now. God love her. I don't understand how she's functioning. Like oh my God, she's so amazing and impressive. Basically for the advisory board, which is the board that we all sit on, like the students sit on, kind of like those who founded the nonprofit, but are like still in school. The commitment is as low or as high as you want it to be. So I'm committing, I wanted to say 10 hours a week. My parents said, don't be ridiculous. You're in college. You need to actually be in college. So I said on paper up to 5 hours a week. 2 weeks into school, I've definitely done more than 5 hours both weeks I've been here. So we'll see. But
is it mostly organizing outreach?
Organizing outreach. It's connecting with different schools in the U.S. who have partner schools who want to work with us. It's working on with different communities. Like so over 94 countries have reached out to us and said that they want machines, and also over, I think, like 30-something states. So we've heard from everyone all over the country and everyone all over the world, which has been incredible, but also incredibly overwhelming because we are still mostly a group of college-age students, now with three adults. So it has definitely been a lot of trial and error, and I spent most of my summer Googling, how does one build a nonprofit? Because none of us really know how to do that. So I think it's very much a learning experience as we go. And I think that we are so incredibly fortunate that everyone working with us has been very patient in that. And like trusting us to take the time we need to like ensure that we are going to be working where we can do the most good. Because I think that like it feels incredible to have so many people reaching out saying we want a machine. But at the same time, we don't ever want to be in a position where we feel like we're just like being irresponsible with our partnerships. Because like if we put a machine in a community where electricity isn't constant and they don't have like great access to clean water, then that's just the word is dumping a bunch of metal on them. So like that's not really an option. And so I think that a lot of it is putting like a lot of time and effort into figuring out who we can work with most effectively and like where we can go first that it's going to make the most impact, and then like looking out and figuring out how we can then build our team to be able to accommodate groups that might need a bit more effort on our part.
Yeah. What are the biggest mistakes you felt like you made on the way with this nonprofit?
Oh God. Many. I mean, we literally first almost didn't get the Kickstarter up because Kickstarter was like, we don't do charities. Like you guys can't do this. And
really?
So we had to, And so we had to like change all of the copy on the Kickstarter and basically just like focus a lot more on the documentary, which like to me felt so disingenuous.
There's no Kickstarters for nonprofits?
No, so you just like GoFundMe or whatever. Kickstarters for like things.
Oh, why don't you just use GoFundMe then?
GoFundMe is, first of all, seemingly it's less legitimate, so we wanted like bigger people to be able to like donate and feel good about it, and also because it takes more on the back end. And so, and like as much support as we did receive from like the Oakwood community and our friends and family, so much of what funded this from the very beginning was the Kickstarter community, because I think that Kickstarter ended up putting us on like the Projects Love page, like on the homepage. And so the Kickstarter community was very, very influential in kind of funding the project from the ground up, which we are very grateful for. So yeah, we kind of had to go back and kind of change everything and focus a lot more on the documentary, which like to all of us was like, okay, well, the documentary is the cherry on top. Like this isn't why we're doing it, but like we did what we had to do to get it up there. And in the end, it ended up being amazing. But I think also a lot of like, I wouldn't even call them mistakes. I would just call them like bumps along the road, because we like would then make a bunch of progress and then realize, oh God, we have no idea. We know where we want to go. We have no idea how to get there. And then spend the next like 3 weeks trying to figure out and like read a bunch as much as we could about like how nonprofits are structured and like how we can do all of this. And like literally just, I don't know, everything you can imagine has been a learning process involved.
Have there been any changes of all the press because the documentary won an Oscar?
I mean, like, no one was talking about us, especially not the nonprofit, before the film started doing well, which, I mean, like, we all kind of joke about the fact that we accidentally did a film festival tour, but we did. It's like, we didn't know what to do with this documentary once we had it. It was beautiful and impactful, but we had nowhere, we had no platform to put it on and nothing. And we just wanted to put it where the most people possible would see it. We didn't care what that site was. We didn't care if we were ever going to get any money off of it. That was never the purpose. We just wanted to get the word out there. And so the only thing we could really think to do, especially because our director had just finished film school, was just submit to a bunch of different film festivals and see what happened. And we started winning film festivals, both in terms of jury awards, so like what the actual film critics thought, but then also audience awards, which I think was really when we started to think, okay, like, people care about this. And we ended up qualifying to enter for the Academy Awards because of a film festival we had won in Cleveland. And none of us really talked about it, but we did end up like submitting, but like, we were like, it's never going to happen ever. And then it came out in, December. And I was literally in the middle of finals. I was finishing a French term paper and I got a text from, Melissa, our executive director, saying like, we just got shortlisted, which meant that we went from 110 films that were eligible who like submitted to 10. And from that 10, they were then going to nominate 5. So we just went from 1 in 10 to 1 in 2. And that was kind of crazy odds to us. And like that, even that, we were like, oh my God, people are not talking about this. Like, I don't even care if we get nominated. There's no way in hell we're getting nominated or winning. Like, people are talking about this, and we can now reach out to like some different platforms, especially like educational platforms, because there's some legitimacy around the film in terms of getting it out there. And then we got nominated. And then we were like, oh, what? And then Netflix reached out and
like, it's just such a chill process, like winning the Oscar and done.
None of it was chill. We were screaming the whole time.
I just meant like, I thought there was like some marketing campaign strategy. Like, we just submitted and things happened.
There was later, once Netflix had taken us on, they put a lot of effort into like getting the word out there to Academy voters and so that we would win, which like we were incredibly grateful for, because like honestly, whether or not we won, like we had a huge team dinner the night before and like all kind of hung out right before the Oscars. I kind of had a very long, like very heartfelt discussion about how like truly none of us cared whether we won or not, because like people were talking, like there was a Teen Vogue article about the fact that some idiot Academy voter was like, I'm not going to vote for a movie about periods. They're icky. Literally used the word icky. And so whether or not we won didn't necessarily matter. Like the film had achieved its purpose. People could watch it on Netflix. People were talking about it. People were talking about Katakira and the impact that something as simple as this machine could have, and like that was all we really needed or ever wanted. And I mean, an Oscar is a lovely cherry on top, but none of us ever went into this like thinking, oh, we're gonna make a movie to go win an Oscar. And none of us like even really necessarily want to go into film. Like, a couple of us I think now do, having seen like the impact that film can have, but like all of us went into this excited about this partnership and this project and the idea of being able to have an actual impact. But like there were just many, many fortunate circumstances along the way that kind of like led to where it is now. And I think, and a ton of hard work, like the amount of sleepless nights and like late night phone calls I had with my English teacher when I was in high school. Everyone was like my school is known for having close relationships with teachers, but not to the point where she's calling me at 11 p.m. every day and we're texting nonstop about like logistics and everything. It's like, it did definitely reemphasize the idea that like young people can do as much as they want to. No one older can say, well, just because you're young, you can't do it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Oh, wait, so you're still in school. Do you know what you want to do next after graduation?
Oh, I have no idea. I have 3 years till then. Don't stress me out.
No, I'm sorry. I'm so shy.
Like, freshman year was long and complicated for so many reasons and amazing, but like getting nominated and winning an Oscar in the middle of your freshman year does not make a normal freshman year. Neither does your mother getting diagnosed with breast cancer. So it was a very complicated year. for so many reasons. So I'm really looking forward to kind of having a normal year this year. It has been, and I'm really enjoying it.
Wait, do you have any advice for someone who wants to get more involved in a nonprofit scene and how they pick like a charity that's right for them or a cause that matches them?
I would honestly just say get involved with whatever keeps you passionate, because that is, especially in terms of like the nonprofit world, maybe the most important thing, at least like what I've seen, because burnout is so real when problems feel overwhelming and huge and depressing. And honestly, sometimes most important thing is just caring, because if you care about the issue, you're not going to give up on it when it gets hard. And there are many issues I care about, and I've definitely started to care about this more as I've gotten involved in it. So, like, I'm not saying it needs to be like the hill you want to die on when you get involved, but I think if you're not passionate about it at all, you're not going to enjoy it. And if you don't enjoy it, you're not going to think it's worth it.
Right, because there's always going to be really hard work and bumps.
Especially in the world of like nonprofit, especially in the world of like human rights and like climate change and so many other issues. Everything you're being working on is going to make you want to crawl into a hole and cry. And even when you're working on like things that feel like solutions, everything you're going to find out and all the obstacles you're going to hit are like going to be upsetting. And so I think it's really important to choose something that you're passionate about, because it'll make you want to shove through all of that, not get stuck by it. And like, that's not to say that I still have so many days where I like get so overwhelmed and stressed out by all of this, and like I can't, like it just feels too big, like how the hell, like. And I'm really glad we're not the only actor in the kind of like menstrual equity arena. Period movement has been doing incredible work. I'm involved in Yale's chapter, and like it feels really good to kind of be entering a community and like an arena where people are like already talking about it, and where people are starting to care. Because I think Period and the Pride Project kind of launched at similar times, in terms of like the world is catching on, which is nice. Because sometimes it can feel very overwhelming and big, like, oh God, there's an entire world of period stigma. I'm a 19-year-old kid sitting in my dorm room in New Haven. Like, there's nothing I can do about that. But I think that like small actions are always make a bigger impact than it seems. It sounds cliche, but I found it to be very true.
Is it cliche or classic? Tangent question, because you were saying money's the biggest issue. I mean, you're saying money's the biggest like blocker with nonprofits. How are you affording two full-time employees?
Especially right after the Oscar, there was an incredible influx of donations, and people have been so generous, I think, because they believe in the cause. And I think the documentary inspired many, many people to donate, which we are so grateful for. I think we've spent as little on overhead as possible. Like this summer, our office was basically my backyard, because like we are trying to keep every single penny focused on what communities we can work with and what we can do next. But the ability to bring on two full-time people as well as our executive director has been so substantial, in the sense that like we're doing as much as we can while in school, but like having people have this be their job and like doing it full-time is like so incredible, because there's always a sense of like I need to keep cutting corners in school or get rid of other things in my life so I can keep working on this, because it is something I'm so passionate about. But like we also all do need the minute to like be students and like do all of that.
Yeah, work-life balance, school-life balance in your
It's
case.
I'm horrible at it.
Okay. I usually give my guests like 30 seconds to pitch anything they want at the end. So I was wondering if you want to use this time.
pitch, like what kind of pitch?
You're so unusual because most people are like, here's my website, sophieashram.com. Like, go watch blog. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Okay, I'll just pitch the pad project. Great. If you have a minute, go check out our website at thepadproject.org, or and our documentary Period End of Sentence on Netflix. We are also all over social media. We have a really fun Instagram that I help run, so you'll see me on the stories a lot. Donate if you can. Literally anything is always impactful, but also just the most impactful thing is spread the word. Talk to your friends about your period. Talk to your friends about fundraising for a local homeless shelter and donating pads and tampons. Share the documentary with your friends. Do all of the above. Do none of it. Have an amazing day.
Hey guys, hope you enjoy my interview with the incredible Sophie Asheim. This is a new podcast, so it would mean the world if you could support us by subscribing and rating the show. And if you're feeling particularly generous, leave a review. If you have any comments or questions for me or any of my guests, please reach out on thenewschoolpodcast.com. Have a great day, guys. Try something new today.